I'll tell you what, one of the hardest things for me when I go through this class is to figure out what not to present to the class. Because there is so much information on this small book. And it is so deep. But I want to try to keep focused on the fact that we are doing Jonah 1.0 and not 2.0 or 3.0. Thank you. And this week, we want to try to stay focused on chapter 1. So that was a lot of things that we thought about reading through the book. Hopefully, you've read it through several times by now. It takes really a short period of time to do it. And it seems like every time that I read it, I see something a little bit differently than I did the time before. But it's also one of those very deceptive books that you read through it and you think that you've got it grasped just by reading through it one time. But certainly isn't the case that I'm finding out. So let's go through and talk about some of the homework that we had from last week. If you did some homework and some study, that's really what we want today, is we want as much as possible for you to be teaching the entire class what you found out, questions that you might have had by going through things. I've done some, I've probably done different than what you've done, so I think we'll all be teaching each other a little bit today when we do this, which will be great. Because I'm still learning the book of Jonah too, on many levels. So I've got extensive notes that should be available tomorrow, and most of them are actual scriptures that I went ahead and put all the scripture down on the notes itself. I like to do that so when I'm going through the notes later, I don't have to get a Bible out. I don't have to keep going back and forth. I just want to see certain things emphasized. So let's start with setting place and time. You remember when we talked about setting, we talked about basically where it took place or some of the place names that are mentioned. What are the ones that are mentioned in the book of Jonah?
Nineveh
is mentioned. It's a big one, right? Kind of the whole point of the book, isn't it? Nineveh. Okay, what else?
Tarshish.
Yep, Tarshish. I spent a lot of time on Tarshish this week studying that one.
Oh, yeah, but that you did.
Wait, what else? What other place?
Joppa.
Okay. So those are the three that I got. Anybody give me any others?
The ship.
That would be a good one. I forgot about that one. Yep. So when we... Let's just take one example. Who wants to go through one example? Michael?
Where did he start from?
Where was he?
When the word of the Lord came in.
Well, he had to be somewhere around Joppa, would be my guess. And when you go to Joppa today, Joppa is kind of a suburb almost of Tel Aviv.
Okay.
So it's right on the coast. And actually, there's some Greek mythology that came from Joppa as well. And it's a pretty famous place. I think Napoleon went through Joppa one time. Joppa was also the place where Hiram sent a lot of the cedars of Lebanon down to Joppa to unload and take over to Jerusalem to build the temple. So a lot of things took place in Joppa. Peter was in Joppa, obviously, at one point in time. So there's a lot. Anything else about Joppa that you wanted to point out, if you guys have did that? Joppa's not a really super important part of this book, obviously, of the story. It's just kind of interesting that he must have been pretty close to Joppa when he got the first revelation. But the nice thing about Joppa is if you go to Israel, you can spend some time there, and there's a lot of history. And Joppa is one of those cities that has been around as long as just about any city on the planet. It's been there a long time. It's called Jaffa today. Same thing, basically. All right. How about Nineveh? Who looked up Nineveh or any of the scriptures on Nineveh? And how did you go about it when you did it? Any ideas? How many people actually looked up something in Nineveh? Okay. Tell me what you found, Jeremy.
Well, it was the capital of Assyria. It had a king. I found some archaeology. The Nineveh wrote these stone tablets. So every year, there was a one-sentence summary of what was important that year. And so usually it was a specific military campaign that Nineveh did or the king did. And for 41 years in a row, there was a military campaign. But then in 769 BC, it just said the king stayed at home. So there was 1 year when there was no war. I was wondering, maybe that's right after Jonah came.
Oh, interesting. That's about the right time frame, too. That's interesting. I didn't see that. Anybody else have any thoughts about Nineveh? Nineveh, I think we talked a little bit about this last week, but if you go to Genesis 10, and this is right up here if you want to just look up here as well. The first time we hear anything about Assyria or Tarshish is in Genesis 10. Does anybody know what Genesis 10 kind of represents in the Bible? It's called by a lot of people the Table of Nations. So it takes Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and it talks about their lineages in Genesis 10. So, and you can take, and what's interesting about Genesis 10 is you can take a lot of these names and you can find cities that are named after them. And that's kind of how they figured out where different parts of Shem, Ham, and Japheth went. So if you look at a lot of the cities in the Middle East, you see a lot of Shemitic son names, right? If you look at Ham, and where you see a lot of the Ham names coming in, that would be in kind of Egypt and Africa and some of those areas, Saudi Arabia. And if you look at Japheth was a lot of his son's names, like Javan. Josephus says that this is the ancestor of the Greeks. So if you look at Japheth, you see a lot of the place names in Europe starting to appear from where Japheth went and his sons and his ancestors. So we see the sons of Japheth. You know, Japheth was one of the three of Noah's sons. You got Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The sons of Gomer are Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togarmah. The sons of Javan, all right, the one up here, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. Interestingly, it says from these, the coastland people spread in their lands, each with their own language, by their clans in their nations. You can see also First Chronicles 1:7 it is. So what we find here is that Tarshish was a son of Javan. So when we look at Tarshish, the only place that we can find what we think is a probable name of Tarshish is in Spain. And Tarshish, obviously, when we see some of these other places here, was connected in some really important way with Tyre and Sidon. You see a lot of connections, especially with Tyre. And Tyre and Sidon on the coastland there, if you can think, visualize a map, Tyre and Sidon is right above Israel, and it would be where you'd see mostly in Lebanon today. But Tyre and Sidon were basically Phoenicia. That's where the Phoenicians came from. Phoenicians were the great sailors of that day. And so you find a lot of things taking place between Tyre and Tarshish, and Sidon and Tarshish, and Cyprus and Tarshish. Tarshish is in a lot of different conversations. So that's basically where it starts from. Any thoughts or questions with that? Again, we're going to go through lots and lots of scriptures, and what we're going to do right now is we're going to look at Tarshish in depth and just kind of talk about how we would come to think about what Tarshish might represent in the Bible. Okay? So now let's go through, somebody turn over to 1 Kings chapter 10. And read verse 21 and 22.
all King Solomon's goblets for gold, all the household articles in the house of the forest of Babylon, pure gold. Nothing was made of silver, because silver was considered of little value in Solomon's days. The king had a fleet of trading ships at sea along with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years, he returned carrying gold, silver, and ivory, and apes, and Babylon.
Okay, now notice how different that translation is from this one. So you call them the ships of Hiram in that translation, and in the ESV it calls them the ships of Tarshish. So you have a little bit of a disagreement on some of the manuscripts there about what that was said. But at the ships of Hiram, Hiram was from, I believe, Tyre. I can't remember exactly where Hiram was from. But a lot of translations use it as the ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of him. Once every 3 years, the fleet of the ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. So it can be called the ships of Hiram or the ships of Tarshish. Actually, Solomon made a fleet as well, and they call them the ships of Tarshish, but they could also call them the ships of Solomon. All right?
Baboons and peacocks are kind of the same too. Huh?
What's that?
That says baboons and that says peacocks.
Right, right. So, interestingly enough, so now we start. What was Solomon's reign known for?
High wealth. There's a lot of wealth.
Tons and tons of wealth, right? Well, now we find a little bit out where some of that wealth was coming from. It was coming from the ships of Tarshish, and every 3 years they would bring all of this gold, silver, and all this other kind of stuff to Solomon. So Solomon is accumulating this massive wealth. What was the problem with accumulating massive wealth that Solomon had?
People would want to overtake you or take your wealth.
They would want to take your wealth. All right. What else?
It corrupted him.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, God said, do not accumulate great quantities of gold and silver for yourself. Do not accumulate chariots and horses for yourself. Do not do any of these things. Yes.
Mary, I thought it was women that corrupted Solomon.
True. Foreign law.
Really, literally, almost everything that Solomon did led to his corruption. Yeah. And his wives stole his heart away. But it was all the other things. Solomon pretty much ignored the commands of the Torah once he got older.
So he made the choices that he made corrupted him and pulled him away from God.
That's exactly right.
So it's all of those, whatever I just mentioned, put together, his choices and decisions.
The choices and decisions, and the things that he set his eyes on, right? The things that he set his heart on are what ended up where he went. And those of us who are studying spiritual disciplines right now, you know, part of the spiritual disciplines that we're studying and going through, things like the Sabbath, silence and solitude, and all these other ones that we're doing, prayer, it's the whole idea of it is to get a consistent focus of your mind on something that's not sinful, right? On something that's good and pleasing and right and righteous and godly. And Solomon just basically ignored that and started looking for all of this stuff and these women and these alliances that he was making, because a lot of these wives that he had were to form alliances with other pagan nations. And Solomon never had to get on a chariot and defend himself. Never once was he at war. But he built the greatest war machine that had ever existed at that period of time. All right? So, somewhat of a little negative connotation to the ships of Tarshish. Would you agree? All right. So we're going to skip over 1 Kings 22 because we're going to read the parallel passage later. 1 Chronicles 1:7 is a repeat of Genesis. 1 Chronicles 7:10 is basically Tarshish here is an unrelated descendant of Benjamin. Now, there may be some significance to this Tarshish here, but I just don't know if there is or not. But we'll skip over that one for now. 2 Chronicles 9 is a repeat of what we just read about Solomon's ships. and 2 Chronicles 20:36 and 37. So, who wants to read that? Who has the ESV version? Does anybody have that? Can you read that?
Thanks. Edifying is funny.
Okay.
He joined them in building ships to go to Tarshish, and they built the ships in...
How do you say that?
Ezion Geber?
Yes. Then Ellie...
I'm probably not the one to read this.
That's all right. Just skip over. Just skip over.
All right. Then Eliezer, the son of... How do you say that?
The Dovahigu or something?
I'm just okay. So he prophesied against Jehoshaphat, saying, because you have joined with this man, the Lord will destroy what you have made. And the ships were wrecked
and were not able to go to Tarshish.
Okay. So the ships, he's building ships to go to Tarshish. So the ships of Tarshish are what? Jehoshaphat joins in with the wicked king of Israel to do this. And God destroys those ships because of his evil alliance. Again, slightly negative portrayal of the ships of Tarshish, right? And again, we're just going to go through these scriptures one at a time, because this is the way I kind of came to a conclusion about what the ships of Tarshish kind of meant. And this is what we would do with any character or any plot or any settings of time and place, is you would do something similar to this. And that's really what the purpose of the class is to take what we learned last time and kind of demonstrate how we would do this in another book, right? So, Esther, Tarshish here is a Persian prince. Again, I'm not gonna spend any time on that one because I just don't think it's that important for what we're talking about now. Psalms 48, 4 through 7, this is in the NIV version. Somebody wanna read that?
When the kings joined forces, when they advanced together, they saw her and were astounded. They fled in terror. Trembling seized them there, pain like that of a woman in labor. You destroyed them like ships of Tarshish, shattered by an east wind.
Just as in Jonah 1:4. All right, was almost took place in Jonah 1:4. So here, when he talks in the Psalms about this, he talks about you destroyed them like you destroyed the ships of Tarshish, maybe referring back to what Jehoshaphat's ships were there. So destroying somebody like the ships of Tarshish became something that you would say, oh yeah, those things were destroyed like the ships of Tarshish were. All right, so it becomes kind of like a phrase that they use in the Hebrew or in the Aramaic there. All right, so let's go on. We're going to come back to that one later. Isaiah 2, verses 12 through 17. For the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the lofty mountains. Easy to find the repeated word here, isn't it? Against all the lofty mountains, against all the uplifted hills, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, and against all the beautiful craft, and the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the lofty pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. So here we can see in the book of Isaiah that Isaiah sees the ships of Tarshish as just another example of the arrogance of man. And the ships of Tarshish, if you think about it, you've got really on the Mediterranean, there are two major cities that become uber wealthy. I mean, really, really wealthy. One is Tyre and one is Tarshish. Now, we don't even know exactly where Tarshish was. We think we do, but we're not really sure. But we definitely know where Tyre was. And Isaiah is going to prophesy a lot against Tyre because of their wealth, because of their arrogance, because of the way that they looked at themselves. And Tarshish had a lot to do with that. A lot to do with it. So let's keep going on. Isaiah 23, 1 through 14, NIV. A prophecy against Tyre. Wail, you ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed and left without house or harbor. From the land of Cyprus, word has come to them. Be silent, you people of the island, and you merchants of Sidon, whom the seafarers have enriched. Who are the seafarers? The ships of Tarshish, right? On the great waters came the grain of the Shihor. The harvest of the Nile was the revenue of Tyre, and she became the marketplace of the nations. So that's kind of what you think about Tyre, the marketplace of the nations. So everything's coming in and out of Tyre on that side of the Mediterranean. And if you want to look at the other side, everything's coming in and out of Tarshish on the other side of the Mediterranean. So these two cities are just and supplying so much wealth and probably exploiting a lot of people in the process to do that. Be ashamed, Sidon, and you fortress of the sea, for the sea has spoken. I have never been in labor nor given birth. I have neither reared sons nor brought up daughters. When word comes to Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. Cross over to Tarshish. Wail, you people of the island. Now the island is Tyre. Tyre was built on an island, all right? In this, your city of revelry, the old, old city whose feet have taken her to settle in far-off lands, who planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants are princes, whose traders are renowned in the earth? The Lord Almighty planned it to bring down her pride and all her splendor, and to humble all who are renowned on the earth. To your land as they do along the Nile, daughter Tarshish. In other words, now Tyre's called the daughter Tarshish. And I thought that was interesting. For you no longer have a harbor. The Lord has stretched out his hand over the sea and made its kingdoms tremble. He has given an order concerning Phoenicia. That's Tyre and Sidon. He has given an order concerning Phoenicia that her fortresses be destroyed. He said, no more of your reveling, virgin daughter Sidon, now crushed. Cross over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest. Look at the land of the Babylonians, this people that is now of no account. The Assyrians have made it a place for desert creatures. They raised up their siege towers. They stripped its fortresses bare and turned it into a ruin. Wail, you ships of Tarshish. Your fortress is destroyed. So this prophecy against Tyre is not only going to ruin Tyre, but it's also going to have a huge effect upon Sidon, upon Cyprus, and upon Tarshish. And so that's why all these ships of Tarshish are, you know, they're going to have all this stuff to deliver and nowhere to deliver it to. All these orders that were put in for merchants in Tyre, and now Tyre becomes destroyed. Does anybody know who destroyed Tyre? Well, Tyre was destroyed. It was really, really powerful because it was just off of the mainland in an island, and nobody could figure out how to take Tyre. Well, Alexander the Great figured it out. And Alexander the Great came over and he told them to, you know, Alexander the Great always gave people a chance to surrender. And if they surrendered, he would leave a garrison there. They would turn it into a Greek city and they could have all the, all the pleasures of being a part of a Greek city. But they wouldn't do it. So Alexander the Great just started shoveling all kinds of stuff into the water and built a causeway across to Tyre. And eventually, after he built a causeway across, he brought siege engines across and he destroyed it and then wiped the entire island clean of everything. There was nothing left but a rock when he was done. And so when you talk about that came from not Alexander the Great, that came from God. Right? God used Alexander the Great to do that very thing. But you can see the ships of Tarshish here, positive, negative connotation. What do you think? Definitely negative, right? So you don't really see too much positive about Tarshish at this point in time, right? And this, that's a big one right there in Isaiah. Isaiah obviously has a lot to say about it. Here's another important one. Jeremiah 10. The context of Jeremiah 10 is God versus the idols of gold and silver. Okay? So again, getting all these different scriptures out and start to accumulate evidence of what you think they're saying about Tarshish. It says, "No one is like you, Lord. You are great, and your name is mighty in power. Who should not fear you, King of the nations? This is your due. Among all the wise leaders of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is no one like you. They are all senseless and foolish. They are taught by worthless wooden idols. Hammered silver is brought from Tarshish and gold from Upaz. What the craftsmen and goldsmiths have made is then dressed in blue and purple, all made by skilled workers. But the Lord is the true God. He is the living, the eternal King. When he is angry, the earth trembles. The nations cannot endure his wrath. Tell them this, these gods who did not make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth and from under the heavens." So what was the gold and silver from Tarshish used to do?
Make idols.
Again, not very positive for Tarshish, right?
Hey, Larry.
Yes.
What year do you think that is?
This one right here?
Yeah.
Well, Jeremiah preached right before and during the Babylonian captivity, so it would have been about 600 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, somewhere around that, right around that area. All right, let's keep going. Ezekiel now. This is another lament for Tyre. Ezekiel, and just like Joe was asking about Jeremiah, he was a contemporary of Jeremiah at that same time. "So Tarshish did business with you because of your great wealth of goods. They exchanged silver, iron, tin, and lead for your merchandise. The ships of Tarshish serve as carriers for your wares. You are filled with heavy cargo, and you sail the sea. Your oarsmen take you out to the high seas, but the east wind will break you to pieces far out to sea, just like the wind that came up against the sailors with Jonah." Ezekiel 38, Sheba and Dedan, this is just my note here, are merchant traders like Tarshish. "Sheba and Dedan and the merchants of Tarshish and all her villages will say to you, 'Have you come to plunder? Have you gathered your hordes to loot, to carry off silver and gold, to take away livestock and goods and seize much plunder?'" So all of these, now we're talking about the merchants of Tarshish and all our villages here. So what can we conclude so far about Tarshish and the ships of Tarshish? What would we say just from this amount of study that we've done? And so you can see, just this is not rocket science that we're talking here. You simply get a concordance out. You get you do a search on your Bible for the word Tarshish. You go through there, and as I did, I just copied every single verse that I could find in the Old Testament about Tarshish. And we got a few more to go through in just a second. But in this one, in this case, we can kind of get an idea that Tarshish might stand for something. So what do you think? What are some of the things you think?
It seems to me that the traders of Tarshish maybe got some of their wealth by just seizing from other people.
Yeah.
You know, so they seized it, and then they went to sell it and make money that way.
Okay, yeah. And think also of, where did the gold come from? Mines. Who got the gold out of the mines? Slaves, right? Who found all these gems? Who accumulated all of this, all these apes and peacocks and all this other kind of stuff that they were talking about? Well, people were out doing that, right? And so they were exploiting people, probably slaves mostly, because you didn't have a middle class like you do today. Almost all of that hard type work was done by slaves. So there was that part of it as well, that there was a lot of people dying to deliver these kind of merchandise to the people of the world, a lot of people. And that was also true in Peru, you know, when Spain had some gold mines in Peru as well, and some of the other countries in South America, and it killed thousands and thousands of native Indians in the Peruvian area. Yes?
Let's call them a ruthlessly ungodly expanding Vidian Empire despot. And if you ever heard anything about King, but, you know, they had some
leader that was just ruthlessly expanding
his little petty kingdom.
Yeah, what was Tarshish about?
Money.
That's what it was about. What was Tyre about? Money, wealth. It was about making wealthy people more and more and more wealthy. Yeah, that's what it really boiled down to. Leslie?
I was just going to say, it continues today.
And it does.
People so we could have our smartphones.
Yeah. What was colonialism about? Exploitation, right? That's what colonialism was all about. It was about more advanced populations taking, or more militarily advanced populations, taking advantage of natives that could not defend themselves. Yes?
Like, don't be fooled, like, where our money is going, you're supporting down for me.
Yeah. And yeah, we have to do that. That's something that I think you're seeing more and more awareness, right, starting to come up about that. And I think it's really a lot of us coming from the younger generation that we really need to listen to, because they've got to handle a lot of the stuff that some people my age don't. Who else had their hand up? Okay. So, Tarshish, this is interesting when I was reading about this. It kind of stands for an exotic, distant nation when it first appears in Genesis 10. A place of gold and silver and gems like those found in Eden. Ezekiel 28:13 talks about Eden being a place of these beautiful gems, gold, all this type of stuff. And this, isn't this interesting? That when you look at the New Jerusalem, this in the book of Revelation, what are the foundations of the New Jerusalem? Gold, silver, precious, the streets are paved with gold. So you've got that. Tarshish has something in common with that. Ezekiel 28, says, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man. Let's see if I get this here. It says, moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, raise a lamentation over the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord your God, you were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. Sardis, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, emerald, carbuncle, and crafted in gold were your settings and your engravings. So when you look at this, Tarshish can be seen as a source of wealth and idolatry and pagan influence exploited to create one's own pseudo-Eden. So when mankind was kicked out of Eden because Eve saw, she took, and she ate, right? And that becomes the pattern that you see over and over again throughout the Bible. When people are trying to build their own Eden, trying to grab things for themselves, you see it here, like they're using Tarshish as a source of wealth to build that pseudo-Eden. And that's the same thing that Egypt did, that Tyre did, that Sidon did, Phoenicia, all of Phoenicia, Lydia, and even Jerusalem. Even Jerusalem, you saw what was happening when Jesus was there. What were the Sadducees doing? They were accumulating wealth themselves, right? They were trying to build their own Eden. Like, they were trying to fill themselves up with things that could not fill them up, instead of God being the one who would fill them up. Instead of trusting God, people look elsewhere for security. They see, as we talked about, that it looks and feels good. They take it and they eat it to create their own versions of Eden, which subjects them to judgment. So really what God is trying to do, if you want to look at the overall narrative of the Bible, God is trying to help people understand, I've taken you out of Eden, but I want to bring you back in. But the way back in is the way that you basically violate it, and it is to trust me and not try to find these things for yourself, not to accumulate gold and silver or titles or power or any of these things. And that's, we live in a culture that is built on creating a pseudo Eden for ourselves. That's the American way, right? And it's gotten intertwined now with the American church, where the American church is kind of the supporting this whole idea of the pseudo-Eden, right, in a lot of different ways. What is America based upon? I'm not bashing America, but I'm just thinking the difference between what God's kingdom is like and what the culture here is like. What's America based on fundamentally?
Getting ahead, getting rich.
Yeah. What else? What does it say? Freedom, right? Freedom.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
What's that?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That's right. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of a pseudo-Eden.
Well, honestly, that's what we think will bring us happiness.
Yeah.
Right.
We do. We do. And we look at the poverty that America has gotten rid of a lot of, right? They created the first major big middle class that's ever existed in history, which is America's middle class is what basically what makes America different and a lot of Western civilizations. But what is God saying that he wants us to do? I mean, freedom, look at what freedom is getting us. What's freedom getting us? It's freedom to do anything we want, to identify as anything we want, to believe anything we want. Is that the kind of freedom God offers?
No.
True freedom is freedom from the slavery of sin.
But there's so much freedom it almost puts us back into slavery.
Yeah.
Because if we don't have it, then we feel
enslaved. Exactly.
That's exactly right. It's totally backwards. The kingdom is built on, just like Jonah is a book that's almost upside down. This is almost the anti-prophet, right? Almost everything Jonah does is against what you would expect the prophet to do. Almost everything that the pagans do is against what you would expect the pagan to do. Everything is upside down. It's the anti-prophet what's doing it. The ships of Tarshish become an image of God's defeat of humanity's search of Eden in their own terms. This was Tim Mackey's suggestion of what he felt. The ships of Tarshish became kind of an image of that. But I think that makes a lot of sense to me. Whenever you see a theologian make a kind of a conclusion like this, it's something that I give a lot of credence to, but I don't necessarily accept it as truth because I want to still consider it. I want to still think about it. I think that's probably right. After going through all of the different scriptures so far that we've looked at, it seems that that makes a lot of sense. And so we're going to go and look at a few other things in addition to that. So let's look at Jonah 1 verse 3. It says, but Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. What kind of ship is Jonah getting on? He's getting on a ship of Tarshish. And if we knew our Bible and we knew now what we know, we think that's probably right off the bat not a very good thing, right? And so why is he going there is the big question, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Jonah 4, It says, but to Jonah, this seemed very wrong, and he became angry. He prayed to the Lord, isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? That is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you were a gracious, compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live. There Jonah tells us why he left, and he flew to Tarshish. Now, whether he's telling the whole truth, we don't know. That's just what he's saying. So was he going to Tarshish because he thought maybe I could go there and get rich? Was he going to Tarshish just because it was so far away? Was he going to Tarshish because he thought God couldn't find him over there? Who knows? The explanation that he makes here doesn't really make a lot of sense. But that'll be for another day when we get to chapter 4. So Jonah flees to Tarshish just as all biblical characters attempt some kind of return to Eden on their own terms. Whatever his motive was, he was going to exactly the wrong place. You would think that for Jonah, who was from the northern area, Geth Hepher, I think it was called. I think we'll get that on there too at some point. But Jonah was from the north, so he had seen a lot of this evil that the Samaritan kings, you know, the northern Israeli kings were bringing upon the land. And so he could have gone to Jerusalem and fled to Jerusalem. That would be more logical for someone who said they believed and trusted in God, right? But he wanted to get as far away as he could, and he wanted to go to Tarshish, which was like, that's like if God told me to do something and I fled to Las Vegas, you know? Like, why is he going to Las Vegas? That's like Sin City. And that's kind of what Tarshish was like. It was one of those places that it just did not make any sense for a man of God who claimed to believe in God and fear God the way that he did. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Now, here's something that's really interesting that I found. I wasn't expecting this at all. Tarshish is eventually redeemed. So the New Jerusalem will receive the gold from the ships of Tarshish, Isaiah 60 and Psalm 72. In the Messianic age of Jesus, the witnesses will go out to the nations, the islands, including Tarshish in Isaiah 66. So let's look at those. Isaiah 60, verse 8. The context here is the glory of Zion, which is another word for Jerusalem. Who are these that fly along like clouds, like doves to their nests? Surely the islands look to me. In the lead are the ships of Tarshish, bringing your children from afar with their silver and gold. To do what? To build idols? No. To honor the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, for he has endowed you with splendor. So now when Isaiah starts talking about the redemption of Israel, Tarshish is a different position. And he says, and I, because of what they have planned and done, am about to come and gather the people of all nations and languages. What does that sound like? Is that like something in the New Testament?
Yeah, it sounds like something from Acts.
Sounds like Acts 2, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds exactly like Acts 2. And they will come and see my glory. I will set a sign among them, and I will send some of those who survive to the nations, to Tarshish. So now he's taking the people that we think are from Acts 2, and he's sending them out to the nations like Paul did. And guess where Paul ended up? In Spain. Paul goes to Spain. In Romans chapter 14 or 15, I think he talks about that. He wanted them to contribute to his trip to Spain. It's very possible that Paul went to Tarshish when he was preaching in Spain. And it says, to the Libyans and the Lydians, famous as archers, to Tubal and Greece, and to the distant... did Paul go to Greece? Yep, absolutely. And to the distant islands that have not heard of my fame or seen my glory, they will proclaim my glory among the nations. So Tarshish is going to be redeemed in the Messianic age, according to Isaiah, because the whole thing is going to get turned on its head. And instead of Tarshish sending all this gold and silver out to build idols, it's going to be brought to honor God. And people are going to come now from Jerusalem to Tarshish, and they're going to spread the word about Jesus to Tarshish itself. I think that's pretty amazing. Pretty cool stuff. So That's what I got for Tarshish. Any comments about how you would do that, how you would go through and do that? Yes.
I just had a comment for earlier. You said, like, Jonah was such a man of God, I guess, and that he might say Tarshish. Do you think it's possible that, like, he thought that Nineveh was too far gone? Like, he was like, maybe I can do it in Tarshish instead. Like, they're a little better. Like, it's so bad there, but I can work for God there, and then my conscience is,
you know, clear there. Hmm. Yeah, I never thought of it that way. I guess that's possible. It's possible. I mean, if you want to take a very, very sympathetic view of Jonah, that would be very possible.
Well, you know what that reminds me of? It's when we all kid, those of us who've been around for a long time, about where we want to plant a church. I know Byers always says, Turks and Caicos. Right?
Yeah, right.
So we think about these wonderful places that I let it live. We start a church there, right? Tarshish might have been a great place in Jonah's time.
Yeah, it could have been. Yeah, probably was. Yeah.
Jonah, he said he wanted to flee. He went to Tarshish to flee from the Lord, but he's a prophet. Doesn't he know that God is everywhere, that you can't flee from God?
Yeah, it doesn't.
Maybe he didn't know it, or I don't know.
It's not really rational, is it?
Yeah, he said that when he was on the ship. You know?
Right.
Yeah. I believe in the God who meets evil.
Oh, yeah.
So.
And it's not. This is not Jonah's first rodeo. We find Jonah in 2 Kings as well, right? So let's read about that. 2 Kings 14, who wants to read 23 through 27? Am I got that?
Second Kings 14.
Speak up real loud, please.
Okay. Second Kings 14, 22 to 27. In the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash to Judah, Jericho, son of Jehoash to Israel, became king in Syria. And he reigned 41 years. He did evil and modest bubbling and did not trail in the unnamed sins of Jeroboam's and Nebat, which he had caused the years in youth. He was the one who restored the body of the girls of Yodokamah to the Destana, and accorded for the word of Lenoi, the God of Israel, spoken to the servant Jonah, son of Imbatai, the prophet from Gath Hepher. The Lord had seen how bitterly everyone in Israel, whether slave or free, was suffering. There was no one to help them. So the Lord had not said to what to what out the name of Israel and the Hebrew. He saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, son of
Okay, thank you very much. Now, who was Jeroboam the second? Jeroboam the first was the first king who took over and split the kingdom from Israel and took the 10 tribes northern. So that's Jeroboam the first. And Jeroboam the first built golden calves in Bethel and in Dan. And you can still see the pieces of the altar in Dan from the golden calf altar that he built. And so he basically did that to keep the Israelites, the northern tribes, from going down to Jerusalem three times a year and celebrating the Passover and all these other things, because he didn't want them to be allied with the south. He wanted them to stay in the north. So he created these other alternative places for them to worship. That led Israel down, the northern tribes of Israel, down this garden path, and they never recovered from it. There was never a good king in the northern tribes of Israel. And generally speaking, the Israelites just became idolaters. And that's what got God eventually to bring the Assyrians down from Nineveh to basically take the northern tribes off into exile because of their corruption and their sin that they just would not repent of after prophet after prophet after prophet was sent to them. So, now in 2 Kings 14, we have Jeroboam the second, and it says he was evil, he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And interestingly enough, then he says, which he made Israel sin, he restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord. Here's an interesting thing if you study that little part of this. That border that he was talking about was the same border that God had promised Abraham. It was all the way into the northern area of the Euphrates River, up, you know, way up there where Abraham was at different times, and all the way down to Egypt. And so it was this massive area. Even King David did not have all of that area conquered. But guess who did? Solomon. So that was the only time in the kings where all of that territory that God had promised Abraham was fully occupied and run by Israelites. Now, God sends Jonah to this wicked king who doesn't ask for anything from God. And God sends Jonah to this wicked king, the prophet from Amittai, and he says, I'm going to restore your boundaries to the same boundaries that I promised Abraham. And Jeroboam II did not repent. He didn't ask for that. He wasn't appreciative of it, but that's what happened. So Jonah comes and said, God's going to restore your territory to this wicked king, and God does it. And then what happens is, so stop and think about this for a second. Did Jonah have the experience with God that he was a gracious and compassionate God before Jonah?
Because I may be just getting confused with chapter 4, but didn't he mention something like that in chapter 1? Or am I just hallucinating?
Yes, he is. He says that you're gracious and compassionate. He's talking about it, Exodus 34.
Yeah. So he already knew who God was, his character. But for whatever reason, he's just not wanting the Ninevites to have that style,
to know that God.
Yeah, and here's an example of where he might have got that idea about God. God, he had already been the prophet that God sent to this wicked king that says, I'm going to give you a blessing that you haven't even asked for.
Yeah, to Jeroboam II.
Yes.
Excuse me, probably getting ahead of things, but makes me wonder why he was so against Nineveh, God, you know, relenting and being compassionate on them, you know, when he was okay with Israel, God having compassion on them.
Yeah. Well, maybe he wasn't okay.
That's true.
Maybe he wasn't. And maybe this is what got him so stirred up when God sent him to Nineveh. Because maybe he saw what God did for Jeroboam II, this evil, wicked king, and he thought, God's going to do this again for Nineveh. You know, God may do this for Nineveh. He says, Jeroboam II is one thing, that's an Israelite, but Nineveh is a whole separate thing. And we don't know this, this is speculation, but this happened about the same time, right? So these are very, very close to each other. It could have been that Jonah went to Jeroboam II first, and then he was asked to go to Nineveh, or it could have been the other way. But it makes a lot of sense that he would have gone here first. Yes?
Okay, so
in Jonah's mind, and I'm just laying this out, and what you just said, God did look to Jeroboam II in a great way, and that he's an Israelite. He's a child of God. The Israelites are better because, you know, God, this is a blessing from God. But Nineveh, they weren't Israelites. They were the Gentiles, and I don't know if there was an attitude yet towards Gentiles, but it's sad. But also what you just said, well, he did it here. He didn't do it there. I don't want that because they're not God's people. They're not God's chosen people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right. And I think Jonah's a good example of a typical Israelite, maybe not typical is not the right word, but maybe a common Israelite, who saw that the fact that they knew they worshiped the right God, they knew they had the right, the law was given to them. They had all of these things. They had the prophets that God had given them. They had Moses. They had all of these wonderful things that they knew all these other nations did not have. And it was very easy to get an attitude toward the outside pagan nations if you were an Israelite, knowing that you had this, knowing that God had appeared to you, knowing that God had chosen you over all these other nations. And why wouldn't you get an attitude toward them? And that's why God, over and over in the Old Testament, is talking about how the nations are going to be redeemed eventually. But it's almost as if they don't see that sometimes. They don't understand why God didn't do that to these wicked, you know, nations. But one thing about Nineveh, we talked a little bit about this last week, they were super wicked when it came to their warfare. It came to how they treated other nations. They weren't Alexander the Great, where Alexander the Great come in and said, hey, if you guys give up, you know, we're going to make your city better than what it was. You're going to have more wealth. You're going to have more opportunity. You know, we're not going to, you know, come in there and kill all of you. Well, Assyrians wouldn't do that. Assyrians came down and said, it doesn't matter if you surrender or not. If you surrender, we're going to kill you. And if you don't surrender, we're going to kill you. And they also, any of the ones they took into slavery, they took them out of their geography and into a foreign land. And that's what happened to the 10 tribes of Israel. They never came back, as far as we know, from that Assyrian exile. They became part of the diaspora all over the world, eventually. So any other thoughts about that? Here's Gath Hepher. This is where he's from. So you can see we're in a northern area here. This is Samaria. And so he's used to seeing, he's used to living around Jeroboam and all these wicked kings. So he had seen that before. Let's just kind of start to land the plane a little bit. We've got a few other things we can talk about here, but I'm sorry, there's a lot of information here. Yes, please, Shane.
I was just going to say, like, if I'm putting myself in Jonah's shoes, like seeing how God, if I was Jonah, like, God used me to redeem Jeroboam II, like, this wicked person, like, maybe if God just redeemed him directly himself and I wasn't involved, like, that'd be fine, and all, on my conscience, I'd be fine with that. But, like, now, as God's instrument for redemption, I become, like, kind of responsible, or, like, the one credited for redeeming this really evil person, and, like, I don't know, like, how other people would like me after that. And so, like, this place, Nineveh, that's, like, the most terrible place on earth, do you want to be the guy who's, like, yeah, I'm the one
gave them a second chance. Like, yeah. No
that's a really great point. I mean, it's not a great way for Jonah to win friends and influence people, you know, it comes down to the Israelites, right? Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a really good point. By the way, that territory that God gave them through Jonah's prophecy, didn't last. Amos came back and he reversed it. And so Amos came back and prophesied against Jeroboam II and reversed that whole situation. Maybe because Jeroboam didn't appreciate it.
Do we know the time span there in the two?
Very close. They're alive at the same time. So I don't know exactly how many years it was. I don't think we can determine that. But it was within a lifetime. Very, very close. All right. Let's see here. So we have Jonah in the book of Jonah. So what kind of person do you feel like Jonah was so far, just from what you've gotten? We're only in chapter one right now, but just kind of what's your take on him right now?
Angry, resentful.
A lot of anger, right? Definitely. A lot of resentment. Yeah, Shane?
Also like putting myself in Jonah's shoes, because I relate to the sentiment, like maybe he loves God when it's easy and when it gets hard.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. Yeah.
I'm amazed at this confidence book here, God, and that he could say, yes, I'm so angry.
No, he doesn't.
That's a pretty. Yeah, that's true. He has a pretty honest relationship with God, doesn't he? Absolutely. Yes.
I think he wants to be used by God, but because he doesn't understand where God's going with it, it's hard for him to see how God might pull good out of such an evil situation. And so he starts maybe reasoning with himself that, okay, well, this is over here, like it's like somebody had mentioned that they were Israelites, so he's maybe redeemed, or, you know, giving them a second chance because they're us. But then he just doesn't understand how God might use it, and so it's not okay with him. And I think he's a lot like a lot of us, because we don't say, like, where are you going with this? You know,
if I don't know where you're going with this, then maybe I don't want to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
I think he's maybe a lot like, I'm losing my train of thought. He doesn't understand that this has implications for his own life, that God is showing him what he will do for humiliation, but and give them a second chance. He's also wanting to do that for Jonah and to give him a second chance and to show again that, you know, he's compassionate, but from somebody who is turning his back on God, running away to be dominant.
Yeah. It almost makes you wonder if that's what he's trying to tell us when we read it, right? He's trying to tell us those things. Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point, which I think is probably true. You know, we're going to have to kind of wind it down here. So let me just say a couple of things. I know we're going to do this next week as well. So I would highly encourage you, to take some of these notes and do some of the homework, right? Take some time and just go through it and write some things down, because the purpose of this class, again, is to take what we've learned in some of the other classes and move it forward to learn to study the Bible in a more deeper, accurate, satisfying way. So I would encourage you to do that. You don't have to do that, but it would make things a lot better, obviously, if you did, and you'll learn a lot more. So the homework for next week, and we didn't even touch on Jonah in the New Testament yet. We can do that at some other time. But the homework for next week is to go from Jonah 1:17 to the end of Jonah 2, basically the second chapter of Jonah. And what's the significance of the great fish that swallowed Jonah? So, and I give you some hints on this one. Look up great sea creatures or monsters. Look up fish or great fish. And look up Leviathan, especially fish and great sea creatures in the book of Genesis, the beginning, the very beginning of Genesis. And then, here's a couple of the key verses to talk about there. And then, where else do you find these, especially great sea creatures and the Leviathan in the Old Testament? Secondly, if you use a Strong's Concordance, which I highly recommend that you do, you're going to find that Jonah 2:1, the word fish, is a masculine noun, and dag in 2:2 is unexpectedly now a feminine noun. So it's almost like the fish goes from being a masculine fish to a feminine fish. What do you make of this, and could it be symbolic of something? And finally, what is the significance of the 3 days and three nights? Where else do we find 3 days or nights in the Old Testament? We know where we find it in the New Testament. Where else do we find it in the Old Testament? And what do you think these might symbolize? So these are really interesting questions. And again, it kind of gives us some hyperlinks to Jonah, to some of these other scriptures in the Old Testament that'll help us to kind of see. Remember, we're trying to think about this. What would the normal Israelite be thinking about, and what does Jonah already assume that we know about the Old Testament? Because remember, these are written to Jews, and these Jews knew their Old Testament pretty well, because that's about the only book they ever read or heard about or heard talked about or listened to in the synagogue. Okay? Any other thoughts or questions before we end up? Okay, Patty, you want to take us out with a prayer?
Father God, we want to thank you so much to be able to gather here in our freedom, to be able to worship you. Father, that we can gather and to think about your words, learn how more deeply they can touch our lives, our hearts, and how we can then share that with others. Father, bless all the people here as we go down to the our worship service, and bless all those who are coming to join us. That may be a pleasing service in Terraponics. We ask this, Jesus, and amen.
Thank you. All right, thanks, everybody.
Amen.